According to current federal sentencing guidelines, convictions for the sale of powder cocaine results in a lighter sentence than for the sale of crack cocaine. With me now for today's Underreported is Jesselyn McCurdy, legislative counsel for the ACLU. She says this sentencing disparity is unfair and fails to address the larger problem of the drug trade. Also with me is Karen Garrison, the mother of two sons who are each serving long sentences in federal prison for nonviolent crack cocaine offenses. And I'm very pleased to welcome them both to the show. Hello.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Leonard.
What are the current federal sentencing guidelines for crack?
Currently, under the federal statute, if you are convicted of selling 5 grams of crack cocaine, you will get a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence. But it takes 500 grams of powder cocaine to get that same sentence. And so this is what is commonly known as the 100-to-1 disparity between crack and powder cocaine on the federal level.
But can they really be compared? Is this something of an apples and oranges situation?
What we have, what the Sentencing Commission, the United States Sentencing Commission, has determined over the past 20 years is, and other federal agencies, is there's really no difference between the effects of crack cocaine on a person's body and brain as they are as the effects of powder cocaine on a person's body and brain. So 20 years ago, when crack cocaine came on the scene, people thought that it caused violence and there were other effects that were different from crack cocaine to powder cocaine. But what we've ultimately found out 20 years later is there's really no difference between the two drugs.
Does mandatory federal sentencing vary on a state-by-state basis? I assume that every state has to impose at least the minimum sentence, but can they even impose a more stringent one if they want to?
It's interesting you ask that question. Under the federal sentencing scheme, the sentences have to be consistent across the board. But what the Sentencing Commission recently recognized is, although under the statute, a person, for example, who had 5 grams of crack cocaine was supposed to get a 5-year sentence, when a judge actually went to sentence that person and had to use the federal sentencing guidelines to determine what sentence that person would get, that person would ultimately get a sentence that was even more than 5 years. So in some cases it would be 5 years, 3 months, or in other cases it would even be up to 6.5 years. And so there was inconsistency between the law and the federal sentencing guidelines that judges used. And so the Sentencing Commission made an effort to correct that recently to make the sentencing guidelines consistent with the mandatory minimum laws.
And we'll get into the Sentencing Commission a little later as well, because there are all sorts of other suggestions there. Karen, how long have your two sons, Lawrence and Lamont, been sentenced to prison for?
Lawrence was sentenced to 15.5 years, while Lamont was sentenced to 19.5 years. He's 19.5 years different, you know, a different sentence from his brother, because he got on the witness stand to defend he and his brother, saying he was not a crack dealer. The jurors found him guilty, so therefore they took him up 2 levels with a sentencing enhancement for obstruction of justice. So they've been there since 1998. June 18th will make 10 years.
Now, how much crack cocaine had they been caught with?
They weren't caught with anything. They were caught up in a conspiracy of hearsay by an informant that said he gave them drugs during a period of time, and said that they were hanging with him all day long, where the professors at Howard University, where they graduated, one came and testified and said that they made good grades and they were there every day, all day.
So they didn't catch them with any evidence? This is simply based on somebody's testimony,
and they were put in a conspiracy with like 13 other people that they didn't even know.
Now, Jesselyn, is this typical?
Yes, this is very typical. A lot of people, particularly what we often call the girlfriend problem, a lot of women often get caught up in these drug conspiracies, whereas they've never seen, touched, or sold any drugs, but they may have a tangential connection to someone who does, and that person actually informs on them, and they end up getting caught holding the bag and getting more time than oftentimes the actual drug dealer or seller, him or herself.
My guests are Jesselyn McCurdy, legislative counsel for the ACLU, and Karen Garrison, whose two sons are each serving long prison terms, 15.5 and 19.5 years, in federal prison for on crack cocaine convictions. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Jesslyn, how long have these federal mandatory minimum sentences been in place? Did this result as a part of the war on drugs campaigns of the 1980s?
Yes. This particular law, this crack cocaine law, came about after the death of Len Bias, mm-hmm. who was a former University of Maryland basketball player and was drafted by the Boston Celtics in 1986. And 3 days after he was drafted by the Boston Celtics, died of a cocaine overdose. It was originally thought to have been a crack cocaine overdose. And then Congress really moved into high gear to enact these draconian laws around crack cocaine in response to his death. Well, what ultimately was found out after the laws were already enacted on the federal level is that Len Bias actually died of a powder cocaine overdose. But nothing has been done 20 years later to correct that inconsistency.
Well, crack is made with cocaine. What makes it different?
The only difference between powder cocaine and crack cocaine is that crack cocaine is mixed with water and baking soda and cooked.
So
that's why there's no difference between the effects on the body, because there's really no difference between the two drugs.
But since it's adulterated, it makes it less expensive,
yes,
more accessible to poorer people.
Yes, yes.
And are the highs pretty much the same? We're talking about cocaine highs in each case?
We are talking about cocaine highs in each case. What has come out over the 20 years in terms of scientific and medical research is that it really depends on the form of administration, not the drug itself, in terms of whether the high is more intense for taking powder cocaine or crack cocaine. So it's really not about the drug. It's really about the way you administer the drug, whether you smoke or snort the drug.
Although I'm assuming that crack is easier to purchase than powder cocaine and less expensive?
Less expensive, yes, because it's less expensive. And so I guess it depends on what your, you know, economic situation is. It is less expensive.
Well, in most cases, we're talking about, because it's less expensive, we're talking about people who come from poor economic backgrounds, more likely different racial backgrounds. Although we have seen Amy Winehouse, the singer who was recently videotaped smoking something that appeared to have been crack. So this is not just limited to inner city lower income people.
No, it's not. What we know from the National Institute of Drug Abuse is that 66% of the users of crack cocaine are white or Hispanic. And so but what we also know from the Department of Justice is that 80% of the people who are convicted of crack cocaine offenses are African American. So there's some type of disconnect between the users and the sellers of this drug, and that's where kind of the racially discriminatory implications come in.
Did you feel, Karen, that there was a racial component to your son's convictions?
I definitely did. I mean, I felt it in the courtroom. You know, you could tell. And when I went to view other cases that were similar to theirs, I saw the disparity of that. It's definitely a race thing. The white boys got the powder cocaine, I want to say beefs or, you know, charges. And the black guys, they turned theirs into crack if it wasn't crack in the beginning. When it went to their pre-sentence investigation report, they put crack in it to make them get more time.
Now, you've become active in the criminal justice reform movement, a direct result of what happened to your sons?
Exactly. This was the furthest thing from my mind. I was a cosmetologist licensed in every way, from skin care to, everything I could do for fashion and retail, sewing, all kind of stuff, making a living. This was never anything I was interested in.
Now, I'm throwing this out to both of you. Craig Morford, who's currently the acting deputy U.S. Attorney General, recently wrote in the Los Angeles Times that we should keep crack criminals in prison because crack cocaine has a far more devastating effect on communities than powder cocaine does.
And, yes, that is an argument the Department of Justice has used and has talked about, put out there, in terms of powder cocaine has more of an effect on individuals and crack cocaine has more of an effect on communities. But what really has an effect on urban communities, and particularly African-American communities in this country, is the fact that again, 80% of the people who are convicted of crack cocaine offenses are African Americans. Those are mothers, fathers, other family members who are being separated from their families. And what we see is a deterioration of African American families and communities because many of those families, those mothers and fathers, are spending serving long prison sentences in federal prison. And so that is really a contributing factor to the deterioration of communities in this country.
The ACLU says that data suggests that 1 in 12 black men are working as informants in the community today. Can that be true?
That is a very interesting statistic.
Sounds like the Stasi in East Germany.
Well, because where the way the federal system particularly is structured is that one of the few ways, in many cases the only way that you can get from under a mandatory minimum sentence is if you, what the government would call, substantially cooperate with the government's case. And so what we find is people are forced in a corner, sometimes lying on people, such as in Karen Garrison's case, her son's case, lie on other people, pull other people into conspiracy to get themselves off, because that's the only way that you can get from under a mandatory minimum sentence, other than if you're a first-time offender.
And there is, on the other hand, in the black community, there's that stop snitching movement, which has had a negative effect as well, because real criminals are protected because of these concerns.
Right. And so I think we have to build relationships. I think particularly police and law enforcement and prosecutors have to begin to start building relationships with people in urban communities, particularly African-American communities, in order to get them to cooperate in cases. Because I tell you, one another factor is, if someone does cooperate in a case, will they get the appropriate protection so that they do not become victims of violence themselves because they're cooperating with the case? And I think that really has a lot to do with people's fear around cooperating in criminal cases, because they're not sure that law enforcement can provide them with protection so that they don't end up being a victim themselves.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, I want to return to this, the whole matter of informant reform, and I want you to tell us the story of Katherine Johnston. My guests are Jesselyn McCurdy, legislative counsel for the ACLU, and Karen Garrison, the mother of two sons who are currently serving long terms in federal prison for crack cocaine convictions. Stay with us. We're back with Karen Garrison, the mother of two sons who are currently serving long sentences in federal prison, and Jesselyn McCurdy, legislative counsel for the ACLU. We're talking about the disparity in sentencing between crack cocaine offenses and powder cocaine offenses. And we were talking about the use and misuse of informants. Can you, Jesselyn, can you talk about what happened with Katherine Johnston?
Sure. So Katherine Johnston was a 92-year-old grandmother who was killed by Atlanta police officers back in the December of 2006. And what happened was the police officers basically were under pressure to meet quotas for arrest and warrants, and they went to a drug dealer and asked that drug dealer about information on people who he was selling drugs to. The drug dealer lied and said that gave the officers Katherine Johnston's address and said, go in there and ask for a man named Sam. He had sold drugs to them. So the officers went to Katherine Johnston's home, bust down her door. She apparently had a gun for her own safety, and the officers shot and killed this 92-year-old grandmother. Well, once they realized that the information that the drug dealer had given them was false, they tried to pull in another person who had been an informant with them before and ask him to lie about the information that they had gotten from the other drug dealer and say that he had given them that information. Well, the informant would not lie about it and decided to go public, and that's how we found out about this Katherine Johnston case, and that these officers really did not have valid information and did not corroborate it before going into her house and shooting at her and ultimately killing her.
What happened to those police? Were they punished?
The last I heard, that's interesting, last I heard they were going to trial for several different charges. I don't know the results of that, though.
Now, anybody who's watched The Wire has gotten a very different image because a large part of it is about these kids who sell crack on a corner and the whole seductive thing of the drug culture for kids who, often very bright kids who don't know what else to do with their lives. Not really the case with your sons, Karen, because your kids were in college?
They went to school almost 7 years to be able to finish working part-time, and the last 2 years they didn't. I really wanted them to finish, you know, and so they needed to really study hard for their LSAT and LSATs and everything like that. The last 2 years they went full-time, but the other years they went part-time and working in the government as young ambassadors as long as they could keep them there. So they were determined to finish college and then go on to law school.
And none of this played any part in the sentencing? Usually,
they didn't take those things under consideration. I had two court-appointed lawyers that the first day they went to sleep at the table. You know, the judge didn't say anything. The marshal didn't wake them up. They just went to sleep, and it was a joke because when my son asked them, "What, you didn't get any rest last night?" they laughed. But we didn't know that the joke was on us.
Now, Karen, are you suggesting that your sons never use crack cocaine?
I couldn't find anyone that said they had used it. When they first get arrested, they get a drug test, mm-hmm. and the drug test was negative. You know, and in 2 years after I had hired this investigator, 2 years later, he told me that he had still been trying to find someone to say that they were drug dealers or users or anything, and said all everybody said is that they went to school. They knew they went to school.
This sounds like a job for the Innocence Project. Do you think that there are a lot of people like that in jail, Jessalyn?
Oh, absolutely. Again, I mean, as you see from the Katherine Johnson's case, there is this problem with pressure that is being put on people to lie about information to law enforcement officers, and law enforcement officers don't do their job in terms of corroborating the information they get, and they run with it, and you see cases like Karen Johnson's twins.
Although
Garrison's twins.
The cops are also being pressured to crack down on drug abusers. There's that theory that was implemented in New York that if you arrest the squeegee wipers and the turnstile jumpers, you're going to prevent a lot worse crime.
Right, exactly.
And that's the theory behind this as well?
Absolutely. I mean, even, again, back to the Karen Johnson case, one of the things that you have to say, the law enforcement officers, at least, even though this is never an excuse for what ultimately played out in that case, the law enforcement officers were feeling pressure to meet quotas around arrests and warrants. And so instead of, you know, truly developing substantial criminal cases, they were going out there kind of making up cases. And this is ultimately what played out in the Katherine Johnson case. And so then when they're putting pressure on informants to give them information, the informants feel like they have to lie to the officers to get the officers off their back, and it just spirals downward.
Now, have there been any proposals for informant reform?
There was a very good hearing in the House Judiciary Committee back in the summer of 2007 on this very issue around informants and around the FBI and the FBI guidelines around informants and the FBI following those guidelines around informants. And so I do think there are some proposals that are being considered to try to deal with this issue around informants and the misuse of informants.
Karen, how are your sons adjusting to prison life? I can't imagine it's anything but torture for them.
Almost 10 years now.
They've been there 2 years?
10.
10 years. So one has 5 more years to go. The other has 9.
Hopefully with this retroactivity, they'll put in a motion on the third that will bring them a reduction.
Now, let's get to that, the retroactivity. Mm-hmm. There were Congressional Sentencing Commission hearings in November, December, to deal with the inequities of cocaine sentencing?
Yes. So earlier I talked about how the Sentencing Commission acknowledged and recognized that their sentencing guidelines were giving people more time than they deserved under the law. And so the Sentencing Commission decided to correct those guidelines. And what they did in December was decide to apply the new guidelines, what we call retroactively, and that means basically for people who have already been sentenced and convicted, to apply the new guidelines to those people as well. So that means over 19,000 people in prison, in federal prison, could be eligible, and that's 19,000 people over 30 years. I want to be really clear about that. We're not talking about 19,000 people that are going to be eligible on March 3rd to have their sentence reduced.
But some of these people probably were imprisoned in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm. And they have served their mandatory minimum sentences, like anybody who will be eligible for any small reduction in their sentence will have served the mandatory minimum sentence, because as I said earlier, there are very few ways you can get from out from under a mandatory minimum sentence. So these people will have served their mandatory minimum sentence, and what really we're talking about in terms of retroactivity is the time they got in addition to their mandatory minimum sentence, which really was not fair, and that's what the Sentencing Commission recognized.
But are they also looking into the disparity between sentencing between powder and crack cocaine convictions?
And that's something that Congress has to do. And so that's what we have been advocating for very vigorously over the many, many years, but particularly over the past few years, is to have Congress look at this disparity in the law that the Sentencing Commission could not resolve because they don't have the authority to do it. Only Congress does.
Well, what have you heard from the Bush administration, from the Justice Department? Have they taken a position on this?
Well, the Justice Department has made it very clear that they are against this retroactivity particularly, but they have also indicated that they may be willing to discuss some change in the ratio, the 100-to-1 ratio itself, but they are vigorously opposed to retroactivity. And Attorney General Mukasey has been on what we call a misinformation campaign about retroactivity, but I want to emphasize the reality is, again, these people will have served their mandatory minimum sentences. Very few will be let out every year, and even before anyone is eligible to be let out, a judge will have to decide whether or not they can or cannot be released from prison. Those offenders who have violence in their background, I doubt very seriously if they will be released from prison. And so this is a very thoughtful process. It's not what Attorney General Mukasey has been characterizing as kind of we're opening the floodgates and sending a bunch of violent prisoners back to communities. We're really talking about a very thorough, thoughtful process about whether these people deserve and have served enough time.
Karen Garrison, has anything happened in regard to your sons, Lawrence and Lamont? Do you have to wait until some more things occur before you can actually try to get them into this?
Well, no, they've exhausted all their other remedies, their appeal and different things. At times, even they put in motions that they gave them the same opinion back as they did for a prior motion. So therefore, no one in the court had time to even read it. So now we're hoping that this goes directly back to the judge or an acting judge in their case, and he'll be able to take the proper things under consideration so that they will get a little reduction and bring them home very soon.
And then they're going to have – they've been in jail for 10 years. That will affect everybody. You're going to have to find a way to get them into a good support system.
I know I have that in place with organizations like Jesslyn's and, Sentencing Project, OSI, DPA, and everything that have helped me. I know that I have it in place, and I work for an organization that's sentencing reform, so I don't think it would be hard for them to get in place what they need.
Are they in the same prison?
They haven't been in the same prison since they were processed.
So they don't even get to see each other?
No, they talked two Christmases ago. They talked on the phone, and that was the first time they heard their voices. And they didn't want to ever do it again. They said, no, Mommy, I'll see him on the street. I don't want to do it again, because it just was too hard for them.
Too painful. Jesslyn, is there any talk in Congress about changing these laws and going after the traffickers instead of people like her sons?
I think there was a hearing on Tuesday in the House Judiciary Committee on this very issue. There have been several bills introduced in the House that would eliminate the disparity, the 100-to-1 disparity between crack and powder cocaine. There was also a hearing 2 weeks ago on the Senate Judiciary Committee that Senator Joe Biden chaired, and he is also sponsoring a bill on the Senate side that would eliminate the 100-to-1 disparity between crack and powder cocaine. And interestingly enough, on the Senate side, there are several conservative members of Congress who are supportive of doing something and reforming this federal law. Senator Sessions has introduced a bill that would reduce the disparity to 20-to-1, as well as Senator Hatch.
Have any of the presidential candidates talked about this?
Senator Clinton is actually supportive of Senator Biden's bill and is a co-sponsor of that bill. And Senator Obama has spoke out and said he thinks something needs to be done about this crack cocaine law.
Now, if it's true that crack and cocaine have the same effect on the body, how do you account for the fact that the popular image of coke addicts is high-functioning business people, and crack addicts are either violent or passing out on the street? Is there no truth to those images?
Well, I think that those images come from television and movies, just as your initial reaction was to relate kind of the concepts around crack cocaine to The Wire. I think that many people relate the concepts around drugs because we don't experience them on a day-to-day basis. We don't live in those communities necessarily where we see drugs that are sold on the streets. We get those images from New Jack City, The Wire, and many other forms of media, and like Wall Street, the movie Wall Street, where you see kind of white people who are using powder cocaine recreationally. And so I think that's where people get their images from.
There's also the other situation. Most of those people who are using powder cocaine can afford it, and so they don't have to commit crimes to be able to pay for it. The crime that they're engaged in is actually abusing the drug.
And you don't see a lot of people selling powder cocaine on the street. And this goes to an issue around where should we really, in terms of the war on drugs, where should we be using our federal resources? Should we be using our federal resources to sweep up a bunch of low-level crack cocaine dealers who will be replaced tomorrow if we don't stop the flow of drugs into the country? Or should we be using our federal resources to try to stop the flow of drugs in the country and stop the tons and tons of powder cocaine that are coming in the country that sometimes result into crack cocaine? We've got to stop the flow of the drugs in this country, and only the federal government can do that with their resources.
Now, Karen Garrison, when you talk to people about your son's plight, are they generally sympathetic? Do you think they understand?
The majority of them can relate in some way. If they don't have a neighbor, they have a family member or someone at work or somewhere, they know about a little about it. You know, when I speak, if I speak for 15 or 20 minutes, in that time, I'm touching on everyone in there in some way. And then things sound familiar, and then things come to them, and they say, well, you know, now I know my cousin's been in prison for 10 years, and they call them when they get home. They're thinking that they're home. They say it's been 10 years. They're not even home yet. It touches on a lot of people. So when I speak, it's like at the end, the questions that they ask me is like, it's kind of, that has hit home, in other words. And they ask me stuff, and they want to know, well, how'd you find this out? Or where are they at? How long have they been there? They know these facilities. They know the different things. They know the states that they, you know, were prosecuted out of. They already know these things. So it's not really an unfamiliar thing.
Now, Jesselyn, can we say that the war on drugs has succeeded because we're seeing fewer drug busts now than we did in the 80s?
No, I think we have to basically conclude that the war on drugs is failing, because what we know is the purity of cocaine, for example, is higher and higher. We're not seeing a ceasing of the flow of drugs into the country, and I would think that's the goal of the war on drugs, is to stop the flow of drugs in the country. What we are seeing is more black and brown people getting caught up in the system, but not seeing a lessening of drugs coming into the country. And so I think that the resources from the federal government when our focus at the wrong level, we need to really focus on stopping drugs from coming in.
And we have to leave it there. Thank you both so much, Jesselyn McCurdy, Legislative Counsel for the ACLU, and Karen Garrison, whose two sons are each serving long sentences in federal prison. Thank you so much for being on Underreported today.
Thank you for having us, Leonard.
Okay. On tomorrow's show, how consumers have shaped the history of the car. Also, the upcoming Brooklyn Makam Arab Music Festival featuring local musicians playing in the traditions of countries like Egypt, Yemen, and Tunisia. Then a new documentary about the trial of the leaders of the 1968 protest during the Democratic Convention in Chicago. And our latest Please Explain is all about carbon footprints. By the way, tune into our Political Projections film series next Tuesday, March 4th, when we'll be talking about how Hollywood has dealt with the cynical side of Washington politics. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Rory Bernstein, Stephen Valentino, and Paula Crossfield. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.